Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. With all the media attention given over to food, there's a group of experts that we have rarely heard from. I kind of think of them as the defenders. And two of them are with us today. Food writer James Vilas is a legendary defender of Southern tradition. Ethnobotanist Gary Nabhan is a champion of biodiversity. What's changed for all of us is we want to know a lot more about food, not only about what to cook, but about how to think about it. Time for those people who've given their lives up to learning and understanding to step up to the plate. So stick around for two of them and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Just Bear Chicken. All natural with a simple commitment to natural food and respect for both animals and planet. Just Bear Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbearchicken.com. Remember the movie King Corn? Two city guys, Ian Chaney and Kurt Ellis, set out to grow an acre of corn in Iowa. It's their hands-on approach to learning about farming and corn in today's economy. Well, they're into a new project, and Ian is on the phone from New York City. Ian, good to have you with us. Now, rumor has it that you are driving around with a pickup truck full of dirt. What in heaven's name is going on?
Well, I'm eating the freshest food possible, I suppose, is one way of looking at it. I moved to New York about 2 years ago and realized I didn't have any place to grow food. And especially after making King Corn, I had a pretty intense desire to grow my own vegetables as best I could.
Uh-huh.
So I took a good long look at the 1986 Dodge pickup truck that my grandfather had given me a few years ago. And decided to give it a shot.
So wait a minute. You really are growing stuff in the back of the truck, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's a fully functioning backyard garden. It just happens to be in the back of my pickup truck, which I drive around in New York.
I'm picturing you going out on a date, you know, and turning to your date and saying, "Would you care for a sprig of arugula?" And you can just reach behind into the truck. What are you growing?
Well, Kurt and I have a number of things planted back there. We actually built a little greenhouse on the back of it in January to see if we could get an early jump on the growing season. So in mid-March, we planted arugula, some mixed kind of cold-tolerant greens like mizuna and mosh and a few other things, planted some peas, and now we've got tomatoes, broccoli, summer squash, chives. In picking out the seeds for this year, I tried to choose seeds that used adjectives like tiny or mini.
Yes.
Especially with things like summer squash, you run the risk of taking over the whole garden.
How big is the truck?
Well, it's a full-size 86 Dodge pickup, so the bed is about 5 foot by 8 foot minus the wheel well, so it's about 1/1000th of an acre.
Oh, yeah.
So a little bit smaller than the acre of corn we took on in King Corn.
Now, I mean, do you consider this a truck farm in the old-fashioned sense of the word? You know, a farm that grows stuff that you take to market in a truck?
Certainly. We've been to a few markets around the city, although mostly we distribute the produce in a CSA program. CSA, you know, community-supported agriculture, like a subscription farm where folks pay a little bit of money at the beginning of the season, and then throughout the rest of the season, they collect their share of whatever comes off the farm. So folks pay $20 for a subscription to our farm and then get an officially unknowable but probably minuscule amount of produce throughout the summer, which we drive to their doorstep.
This may be the smallest CSA in history, 5 feet by 8 feet.
It's certainly not profitable.
I can understand that. What do people say when they see you driving around the city with this stuff growing in the back of the truck?
Well, Kurt and I took the farm on a little week-long tour last week to visit some schools around the Northeast, which was wonderful, and to see young people's eyes light up when they see what you can really do with a pickup truck. But as we were coming back into Manhattan through the Holland Tunnel, we got some got pulled over by some cops who suspected that we were growing marijuana in the back of the town. We said, well, we're pretty stupid, but we're not that stupid. So I think generally it just elicits a chuckle. I pulled up to a gas station last summer, and it was a full-service gas station, and I happened to glance in the rearview mirror just as the guy who was pumping the gas sneakily reached over and plucked a cherry tomato and ate it. So it's an edible park.
What a dynamite idea. I absolutely love it. Hey, Ian, thanks for talking with us, and say hello to Kurt for us.
You bet. Thank you.
Okay, bye. Bye. Gonna dig down in the dirt, feel it between my toes. I'm gonna find out what every farmer knows way down in the dirt. Dig down, dig down. Chaney makes movies with his cohort, Kurt Ellis. There's more information on the truck farm on the website, splendidtable.org.
I'm gonna dig down in the dirt, plant good things to eat. I'm gonna heal it in with my own two feet. Yeah, down in the dirt. Dig down.
You know, there are moments in the kitchen when it's like trying to capture lightning in a bottle. Dive in, or the moment's going to be gone. You know, in spring and early summer, it's the time for the first new lettuces and the sweet peas. Now, there's this French approach to peas and lettuce, where you cook the lettuce with the peas, and the two together taste of the freshest spring green you can imagine. And it is a little bit like catching lightning in a bottle. Try the recipe, okay? You can find sugar snaps coddled in new lettuces on the website, splendidtable.org. From a woman who approaches every new eating out experience like a 5-year-old on Christmas morning, there's a lot of heartbreak out there, which is why we so appreciate the guidance and the brilliance of Jane and Michael Stern and of their website, roadfood.com. Jane, Michael, good to have you back. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So what about you guys?
Lynn, we'd like to introduce you to a wonderful cheeseburger in Sacramento, California. I suppose it would be possible to go to the Squeeze Inn and get a hamburger, but that would be foolish because the great thing to eat at the Squeeze Inn, which is a tiny little coffee shop, really, is a cheeseburger. It looks unlike any cheeseburger you've ever seen.
What does it look like?
Well, I...
Wears a skirt.
It wears a skirt. That's a great way to put it, Jane. It's probably the best way to describe what it looks like is to tell you how they cook it. I mean, they get a nice big, not huge, but nice-sized hand-formed patty. They put it on the grill.
A third of a pound.
Yeah, it's a third of a pound patty. They put it on the grill, cook it a little bit, flip it, and then mound the top of it with shredded cheddar cheese. And then cover it with something. I'm not sure what, but enough so that the cheese kind of steams and starts to melt.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is the cheese kind of melts, the big mound of cheese melts down off the sides of the hamburger onto the griddle. And when it hits the griddle, it starts getting sort of chewy and crisp.
Yeah,
and
they
fold this up a little bit, and then when finally the burger is done, they scoop it off and put it in a bun so that there's still melted cheese on top, but all around the edge of the burger is kind of crisp, crunchy, sometimes chewy cheese that is just a joy to nibble and eat before you get to the actual patty of beef.
You know, when you describe it, I'm thinking it's like a grass skirt almost.
Yes.
It sounds like if it's in shreds. That sounds fabulous.
It's really good. And what's so good about it is the quality. I mean, it's a kind of a novel idea and clever looking, but it's good cheddar cheese, and the hamburger itself is not just a preformed patty. I mean, it's a really good hunk of beef, and it's just a really fun place to eat. I mean, the French fries are excellent. You can get a milkshake. I mean, it's just kind of a good old fashioned. It's not really a drive-in, but it has that spirit.
Michael, in the hamburger wearing a skirt category, how does it compare with Shady Glen in Manchester, Connecticut?
It's very similar because the hamburger at Shady Glen, which we've spoken about with you, Lynn, it's similar in that the cheese melts onto the griddle. But at Shady Glen, they use American cheese and they use slices so that it's a much thinner layer. There isn't as much on top of the hamburger, and the cheese doesn't have as much of a tang as you get on a squeeze burger.
Also in Manchester at the Shady Glen, if I remember right, instead of the skirt effect, it's sort of triangulation. Aren't there four triangles of cheese coming off the burger?
Three or four, depending on whether you get medium or large. And furthermore, the way they fold they tend to fold the cheese up more at Shady Glen, so it resembles more the petals of a flower than it does a grass skirt.
This is an excellent dissection of the art of the cheeseburger. I think this is fascinating. The skirted cheeseburger, excuse me. But are there any condiments they add? You know, the pickles or special sauce?
Yeah,
or
you can put all your normal, you know, stuff on it. But, you know, maybe it's my condiment phobia, but the real thing of interest is not the pickles and the ketchup or the mayo, which I don't understand why people put on hamburgers. But it's the you've been to the main terminal of JFK Airport.
The
Saarinen building, you know,
or
the Yale Whale, that you know, giant sort of architectural splendor. If you can sort of transpose that into a hamburger, it's the cheese swooping off it into like this wonderful architectonic thing.
It is an edible OJ
dart. Am I making any sense?
Yes, no, you are. And I'm also thinking if McDonald's is listening in, we may see a whole new, you know, approach happening with a sesame seed bun and special sauce.
Or not.
This requires a lot of skill. Not just anyone can flip a squeeze burger, let me tell you.
Guys, thank you.
Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
She goes, squeeze me. Come on and squeeze me. Come on and I'm so in love with you. Mama's got a squeeze box, Daddy never sleeps at night.
The Stern's latest work is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now you can get their restaurant picks by listening every week or anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Gary Nabhan on the man who died for biodiversity, and James Vilas on the great meat of the South. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is supported by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. Right now, gardeners everywhere are casting their dreams in the dirt. But do we know who to thank for those seed options? There is one man, Vavilov, Nikolay Vavilov. He lived long ago in Russia, and he set out to end hunger. Ethnobotanist Gary Nabhan received a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, and he's a founder of the Renewing America's Food Traditions Collaborative. He tells Vavilov's story in his book, Where Our Food Comes From, retracing Nikolay Vavilov's quest to end famine. Gary, it's good to have you back with us.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, Lynn.
So Gary, what made Vavilov so famous?
He was the world's greatest plant explorer. He collected more seeds and tubers and fruits from around the world than any person in human history. And he started out collecting seeds in about 1916,
right,
and worked up until his arrest in the early 1940s and imprisonment by Stalin.
Could you tell us that story?
Well, Vavilov was collecting seeds in the borderlands of Russia and Eastern Europe when he was apprehended, and he disappeared in front of his staff. A car came up with KGB agents in it, took him away, and as World War II rolled up and into Russia, no one knew where he was. It ends up that he had been imprisoned just a few blocks away from where his son and his wife were staying, and they never knew that he was there.
Oh, my.
And after over a year and a half of eating frozen cabbage and moldy flour, he died of starvation. The man that taught us the most about where our food comes from and tried for over 50 years to end famine in the world died of starvation in a Soviet gulag.
And he was a very famous scientist in Russia, right? And Russia was famous for its famines that used to wipe out thousands and thousands of people.
Over the years, decades and centuries prior to Vavilov's birth, there were 120 famines triggered by drought or catastrophic weather events that killed millions and millions of people. During his lifetime, there were three famines that killed millions in Russia, and the last one was largely due not to a drought, but due to Stalin's collectivization of private farms and turning them into an assembly line production system that reduced yields in Russia because all of a sudden no farmer owned his own land and had control over his crops. And so, ironically, Stalin needed a scapegoat for this famine and the failure of his collectivization of farms, and he chose Vavilov.
Now, Vavilov traveled all over the world. You said something in the book about five continents collecting seeds and culture.
Vavilov was an incredible explorer of food diversity. He traveled to 64 countries on five continents collecting seeds. He learned 15 languages. And so he was one of the first scientists to really listen to farmers, traditional farmers, peasant farmers around the world, and why they felt seed diversity was important in their fields. And so all of our notions about biological diversity and needing a diversity of foods on our plate to keep us healthy sprung from his work 80 years ago. And if justice be done, he would be as famous as Darwin or Luther Burbank.
Now, his death, very tragic, but all of these seeds, from what I understand, went into a seed bank in St. Petersburg, right?
That's right. There's something in St. Petersburg, just a few blocks away from the Hermitage Art Museum, one of the great museums of the world. There is a seed bank down in the basement of a stodgy old Russian building that had not only his 220,000 seeds, but another 150,000 from other collectors. And during the siege of St. Petersburg in 1941, the staff locked themselves in that building. They didn't know where Vavilov, their leader was, but they were so dedicated to the mission that they shared to collect and conserve the world's food diversity that they locked themselves in to protect the seeds both from the Nazis and from starving people in their own streets who wanted to find grain or potatoes of any kind and eat them. And over a series of months in 1942 and 1943, a dozen of the scientists starved to death while guarding those seeds. And one of them said, it was hard to wake up. It was hard to get on your feet and put on your clothes in the morning. But no, it was not hard to protect the seeds once you had your wits about you, that saving those seeds for future generations and helping the world recover after war was more important than a single person's comfort.
That seed bank today, does it still exist?
I've had the blessing of visiting the seed bank in St. Petersburg, and we looked at a wall of photos of the people who died protecting those seeds, and I've never been so deeply moved by the courage of scientists in my life, that they put humankind before their own personal lives seemed to me an astonishing act.
Gary, it's an amazing story. Thank you for telling us.
Oh, I'm grateful to be here with you.
Gary Nabhan is an ethnobotanist and author of Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolay Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. Well, to inspire you to eat more from the vegetable world, check out our recipe for crisp cucumber shrimp in retro goddess dressing. You're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, Gary Nabhan and Nikolay Vavilov share something in common with food writer James Vilas. Each one works or worked because of a belief. With Jim Vilas, it is heritage and tradition. He is a Southerner. He's by birth, by passions, and by appetites. Jim was food and wine editor of Town and Country magazine for 27 years. He's done many books on Southern traditions, including a Bacon dissertation. Well, now he's come out with the magnum opus. It's simply called Pig, King of the Southern Table. Jim, good to have you back.
Good to be back, Lynn.
So, Jim, once and for all, how did the pig come to be so important in the South?
Well, Lynn, I guess literally the way it became so important is when it was brought over by Hernando de Soto in the middle of the 16th century into Tampa, Florida. He brought about 13 of them in. And the pig, like no other animal, it was very quickly discovered, you know, that it was not only easily housed and fed and cared for, but that there really was no other meat that could be salted, smoked, air-dried, preserved, and so forth like the pig. And so it was immediately adapted, you know, and also it's been our symbol of survival for centuries. And later after that, even, you know, up in Virginia with Thomas Jefferson, he was importing boars to crossbreed with some of his pigs, and by the early 19th century, you've already got Smithfield producing hams that Queen Victoria was ordering, and it's been our glory and our survival.
What's interesting is that, you know, the pig flourishes in a lot of places,
right?
But it seems the South, you guys have figured out all of these things to do with this animal.
Well, don't forget, we had some history on our side. We were settled first, and we've been doing this now for over 300 years. And don't forget also, very important is the black culture. I mean, after all, pig always figured very, very significantly in what we call soul food.
Well, that's true, but that goes back to the business about being able to use, and not just use, but make delicious everything, I guess, but the hooves, and I guess the hooves were used to make jelly or something.
Sure, right? They do, because they're gelatinous. And don't forget, what we say is we eat everything except the oink.
Yeah. You're aware this new kind of restaurant trend now is nose to tail, right?
Right.
And, of course, what you're talking about is people were eating every single bit of the animal out of necessity.
Right.
Long before this became a trend.
Right. And, Lynn, look what's happening to pig belly. I mean, you must certainly remember the day in which no one even, if they knew what pig belly was, they certainly weren't going to eat it. It's the trendiest thing on New York menus now.
Exactly. And it's, of course, it's utterly delicious. I'm very delighted to know I can go into a restaurant and get pig belly. I just don't want to pay the price for it.
I know. It's wonderful. And I predict the next trend after this is probably going to be hog jowl.
Well, it's in Italy, they call it guanciale, and it's selling for $20 a pound.
Exactly.
Yeah. But the bits and pieces that we never see if we don't live in the South, can you talk a bit about those?
Well, it's incredible, Lynn. I just got back from North Carolina. I mean, to compare a market up here or in the Midwest where I've also lived with markets as you see in the South, any market has an entire division dedicated to the pig in which we've got, I mean, you sit there and stare at pig's ears and pig's trotters and pig jowls and a lot of pig belly and chitlins, and I could go on all day. Souse, you know what souse is?
No, what's souse?
Souse is sort of we call it a poor man's pate, you know, made with a head cheese of a hog.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's wonderful. It's an acquired taste, of course, but it's really wonderful. But up here, I'm lucky, you know, you see pork loins and maybe a shoulder or so. I'm lucky to see only a Jimmy Dean package of sausage. Which is not a bad sausage, by the way, I guess.
Yeah. You don't sound very happy about it.
No, I just got an email from my beloved colleague, Jean Anderson, and Jean has Sarah Moulton now visiting her, and Jean was ecstatic in the email because she said, Sarah has just had her first taste of Niece's hot sausage. Well, I know exactly what Jean's talking about. And
what is Niece's?
Niece's is a wonderful sausage. It's a commercial sausage. It's not like the whole hog sausage I just found down in Wadesboro, North Carolina. And that's another whole story. But Niece's is produced in Greensboro. And I grew up on it. And it's a wonderful sausage. And it's got just the right ratio of fat to lean, which most sausages today doesn't. And I'm just so sick of having to deal with sausage that doesn't have enough fat in it.
What about this sausage you found in Wadesboro?
Well, that's a long story. I grew up on what is called whole hog sausage, which means it was made with the whole hog after the slaughter. I couldn't find the damn stuff. And finally, someone put me on the track and said, there's a little market in Wadesboro, North Carolina, where they're still making it. I go and find this filling station, gas station, and I couldn't believe it. And in the back of the gas station is this wonderful little counter, and here is this glorious sausage. And so I brought 4 pounds back, and I've got it, and I'm debating about it now because I don't think it's got enough fat in it. It's got wonderful flavor. But everybody in this country is obsessed with fat now.
All right, so I have to ask you, what do you think about the new white meat?
I'm not too terribly happy about it because, naturally, it's leaner. Hogs are being fed differently, and we simply don't have the flavor that we used to have. That's in all cuts, you know. And the one reason probably, Lynn, that I'm cooking much more shoulder now than I am loins, because at least we've got some fat in the shoulders.
You know, the idea of what we don't know about great uses of the pig that Southerners grow up with, what are some of the dishes that maybe we've never heard of that are just incredible and use parts of the pig that maybe
Hobody.
What's Hobody?
Hobody is we don't know the real derivation of the word. It probably came into Charleston with the boats that came in there. I grew up on Hobody. It's a meat custard pie. It is glorious. Curried. That I used to have it for breakfast at a place called the Fort Sumter Hotel. But my grandmother would also make Hobody, and Mama would serve Hobody for lunch.
So is it curried pork? Cooked in a custard?
That's correct.
Ooh.
Which means, I mean, I'm sure it's Indian in some respect, and that has to do with the spice trade. But it's glorious.
Jim, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's so good to talk with you. Hope you enjoy the book.
I'm going to.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
James Vilas has written Pig, king of the southern table. Now, that special dish from Charleston that he talked about, hobody, check it out. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to take a look at the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It is time for us to talk. You can call us at 800-537-5252 or send an email, splendidtable.org. Anything you want to get into, we're game. Okay, we have got Andrea on the phone from Hillsboro, Oregon. Andrea, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I want to talk about what to have with a pickle tasting.
Okay, you've got to tell me about the pickle tasting. Why are you tasting pickles and what are you tasting?
I moved to Oregon a couple of years back and I decided that moving here, I really wanted to can things and grow things.
Right.
So last year, I was like, why do you have to stick with apple cider and white vinegar for pickles?
Right.
So I made dill pickles with additional vinegars, including red wine vinegar, malt vinegar, and rice wine vinegar.
Wow, this is going to be really interesting. So are they all tasting different? I mean, is there a different flavor for each one?
Oh, definitely. You can really tell the difference between the different types of vinegar.
So you're going to have a pickle tasting, and the question is?
What do you serve at a pickle tasting to go with the pickle?
Well, the first thing I can think of is don't serve wine. That's going to take down wine very quickly. Okay, you want to cleanse your palate between pickles, and pickles are tart because they're made with salt and they're made with you're making yours with acid.
Yep.
And they're salty. You need a neutral. I think what you really need is some good chewy bread that does not have any sourdough quality to it. You know, none of that business, because you don't want that flavor. You may want a classic baguette or something with whole grain, but nothing that has herbs added or garlic added or anything like that. That, I think, is going to be the perfect thing. I mean, it doesn't sound very exciting, but I think it's going to cleanse the palate a bit. And because you need to absorb that acid, you need to do something to kind of cancel out that acid.
I have a friend who's gluten intolerant.
Well,
what would I have for her?
Rice cakes.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, or rice, something that's rice-based, because rice would do the same thing. And by the way, now that I say that, you know what would be really nice to do is to have little bowls of rice for people, too.
Okay.
With chopsticks.
Fun.
You know, and do a simple rice, but do a rice that has some character to it. So it might be a basmati. But at any rate, rice would be really nice with this. And it would tend to absorb, again, some of that acid.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, hey, enjoy the pickle tasting. I think it sounds like a hoot.
Thank you. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Hey, thanks for the call, Andrea.
Thanks.
You take care. Bye.
You too. Bye.
Okay, I have to tell you, I love pickles. I mean, I will eat almost anything pickled, especially if it's a sweet pickle. But the idea of doing sort of the same pickle recipe with different vinegars, that is very cool. Really super idea, something to file away. Call us 800-537-5252 or send an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the latest snack to be redesigned? I'm going to be back in a moment with that answer and taking more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be getting back to talking with you in a moment, but first I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the latest snack to be redesigned? Well, it's the chip that's been made into a Slim Chip, completely calorie-free because the chip is made from paper. This is how desperate we are. Okay. There is a man in Iceland with a delicious sense of humor. He is the chip's designer, Hafstein Julesson, and this is what he says. This is the motto of the chip, okay? Don't get fat, eat nothing. And by the way, nothing comes in blueberry, peppermint, and sweet potato. Very silly, very tongue-in-cheek, and very colorful. Okay, back to your calls and your emails. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see who is up. We've got Andrew calling from India. Hey, Andrew, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I am looking for a really great Indian cookbook. I really love eating the food here, and I need to know how to make it at home.
Okay, well, wait a minute. Before we get to your question, let me ask you my question. Where are you in India?
I'm right now in Jaipur, which is in the state of Rajasthan. It's in northwestern India. I'm here studying architecture with a group from North Dakota State University.
How fascinating. So are you looking at the history of architecture?
Yeah, well, it's an urban design studio. So we're looking at Jaipur as an urban like space. And also looking at traditional architecture and then also recent works in India as well.
Fascinating. Okay, so you want an Indian cookbook that you can use to recreate what you're eating there. So first
of
all, tell me the kinds of things you want to recreate and it can give me an idea of where we can go with this.
Rajasthan is really vegetarian. So I would love to have some great dal recipes. Roti and naan are, of course.
The breads, like, yeah.
All the time. Dosas are definitely a requirement.
Oh, that's the big fermented. It's a fermented rice batter, and it makes this big pancake, and you roll it around a little bit of a sort of a curry mixture or whatever. Yeah, that's from the south of India, right?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I think I have the basic idea. Here's two thoughts. First of all, two names always come to me immediately when I think Indian food and really reliable recipes. One is Madhur Jaffrey. She's been writing about Indian food for maybe 30 years. She's from India. And the reality is, if you look at any of her Indian cookbooks, you're going to find a lot of what you're looking for. The other person is Julie Sahni, S-A-H-N-I. And she did the classic Indian cookbook a long time ago, but she's done a book on, as I remember, regional Indian food. For the south of India, the one book I know that you're going to find dosa in, and you're going to find a lot of the other things as well, is by an author named Maya Kamal. And she, the name Kerala, the region in India or the state, is in the subtitle of the book. And it's wonderful food and the recipes are really doable and there's a lot of good explanation. And that's what all of these three authors share in common.
All right.
Does that help
you?
Does that help you out?
It does. Thank you very much.
You are more than welcome. Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Call us 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. We have Linda calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Linda, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, I want to start by saying how wonderful your show is and what a difference it's made for me.
Oh, thank you. Thank
you. You're most welcome. I ended up with a bag full of scarlet runner beans.
Oh.
And I love beans. I love to cook them. I just think they're so wonderful. But I don't know what to do with these, and I don't want to spoil them. I don't want to ruin them.
So these are the dried beans,
yes.
Right? And they're reddish color with splotches of black. Do I remember
yes.
that right?
And they're so gorgeous.
Oh, I know they
great
are.
Great big. Oh, they're beautiful, and I'm guessing they're just darn tasty.
Oh, first of all, I've rarely met a bean I didn't like. I mean, but I agree with you. These are gorgeous. Well, here's the basic thing about almost all beans. Yes, they each have a different flavor, but there are certain basics. Like, for instance, one of the great ways to cook beans, and I learned this from, I can't remember his first name anymore. He does heirloom, Rancho Gordo is the name of his site, and it's ranch, and he does heirloom beans, and they're fabulous. But he sautés celery, carrot, and onion
and a little olive oil in the bottom of the pot you're going to cook the beans in. Ooh. Until it's softened. And he seasons them with salt and pepper. You know, they always hear, don't put salt in the beans. Right. Well, that's not, forget it. And he's soaked the beans. He drains them. He puts them then in the pot once those basics are sautéed with maybe garlic. I always throw in herbs that are about what I might want to do with it later. And water to cover by a couple of inches. And he cooks them really slow until they're tender, but not falling apart. And depending how fresh your beans are, that could be 45 minutes or it could be an hour and a half or 2 hours. Now, scarlet runners, if I remember, have a taste a little bit like a really young lima bean. I mean, I think I'm right in saying there's a kind of interesting sweetness to them. Mm-hmm. So I think if you were to do this kind of basic approach, but throw into the mix a cinnamon stick or two.
Ooh.
And a little bit of ground allspice.
Oh, and my favorite spice in the whole wide world.
You know, these are two what I think of warm spices. Mm-hmm. And cook the beans, all right? Now, they're going to make a delicious broth, by the way.
Oh, sure.
And once they're cooked, you can then add to the pot a little bit of red wine, because anything acidic will stop the beans from cooking so they won't fall apart if you cook them further, you see?
Could I use balsamic vinegar?
Oh, absolutely. It would be wonderful.
Okay.
It would be wonderful. And I would add the vegetables that please you, and I would simmer that just until they're tender, and I would serve it as a soup or a stew.
Ooh.
And the other thing that's delicious is to cook them, save some of that bean water, cook them the same way with celery, carrot, and the onion, right? Save some of the bean water, saute up a little bit of bacon with onions and a lot of garlic, add a little bit of brown sugar, throw the beans in there with the liquid in a shallow dish and bake them slow until they're caramelized.
Ooh.
And, you know, it's just my mouth is watering at the thought.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is just not, and by the way, cinnamon allspice would be great in there. A little vinegar would be great in there. And if you wanted to throw in some hot spice, it would also be delicious as a contrast.
This sounds almost, without the bacon, a little bit Mediterranean with the cinnamon.
Yeah. And it's a little New England when you throw in the bacon and the sugar.
Yeah. Can I do this when there's nobody home?
Yes, you can. Yes. And they never have to know it ever existed.
Yeah.
So I hope that helps you.
It's exciting. I can hardly wait. And if I plant a few of them, will the world end?
Oh, no. I don't think so. And by the way, they evidently grow to be like 6-7 feet high, and they wind around. We're talking scarlet runners. They wind around things. And I'm thinking I'm going to start planting beans around my pole that holds the clothesline.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, I used to do nasturtiums, but now I think I'll do nasturtiums and beans. You can eat everything. The flowers, everything. Yeah.
Oh, yum.
Hey, Linda, thanks for a great question.
Lynn, thank you so much.
You take care.
I plan on it. You as well.
Thank you.
Bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. And think about planting, right? Now, for those of us who are black-thumbed, you know, from birth, nasturtiums, you can eat the flowers, you can eat the leaves. They're great in salads, and they are these beautiful flowers. And if you train nasturtiums and climbing beans, you know, that have great flowers, like scarlet runners have scarlet flowers, and you put them on a pole or up a side of a building, trust me, they are very hard to kill, and they get along well. And it's sort of partially having supper just growing out there. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Go online, splendidtable.org. We got an email from Jennifer in Minneapolis, and she says, my husband and I are interested in trying our least favorite meat as when we were kids, that is beef liver. But we'd like some suggestions on how to prepare it other than the traditional liver and onions. Okay, Jennifer, here's the deal. Number one, if you're going to eat liver, it's got to be from an animal that is organic. That's number one. Number two, the trick with liver is you don't want to cook it too fast, and you don't want to cook it too long. So what you would do is you might slice it so it's about a half or an inch thick, okay? And I would take a pan. I would put some olive oil in the pan, get the pan pretty hot. I'd put the slices of liver in the pan with salt and pepper, sear them quickly, and then bring the heat down very, very low and cook them really slow until they're just about firm. Okay, turn them occasionally. I'd take them out of the pan, let them settle, All right. Let them sit about 10 minutes. And what you're going to do in that pan is you're going to add some chopped up shallots or some garlic and onion, either one. And you're going to swirl in some port or Madeira wine with a little red wine. And you're going to boil that down to almost a syrup. And you're going to be scraping up all the good stuff from the bottom of the pan. And what you're going to do is you're going to pour that as a sauce over the liver. And if you serve that liver with mashed potatoes, it's going to be fabulous. Okay? So that's what you can do with liver. And thanks for the email. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. We have Topher calling from Mooresville, North Carolina. Topher, did I pronounce that correctly?
You certainly did. I got on the first shot. Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question regarding rack of lamb. I love rack of lamb. The rest of my family does not. So I have found a local farmer here, Wild Turkey Farms here in the Carolinas, and he's got this wicked good lamb.
Oh,
and
boy.
So I picked it up from him at the farmer's market. And every time I've had it, or if I buy it from a butcher, from a grocery store, it comes, the rack comes already Frenched off.
Meaning that somebody has taken those long ribs that come off the rack and they've shaved them to get rid of the fat and the extra meat. So you've got just shaved bones sticking up and it looks
Correct. Very
elegant. Yes.
Yes. Yes. But when I got it from him, it wasn't Frenched.
Right.
And so I took it and I brought it home and there is just beautiful meat in between the bones.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is Frenching for purely aesthetic purposes, or does it serve another purpose? Because I kind of want to use that meat that's in between the bones.
Well, it is purely aesthetic.
Uh-huh.
Now, the meat and the fat that's on the bones is a bit chewier, okay, than the meat that's at the heart of the rib. But between me and thee, I love gnawing on those things.
Yeah.
So you could just cook your ribs just the way, you know, your rack just the way you normally would and leave the meat there, leave everything there. And then when you slice through it, you've got all this great chewiness going on. I mean, for me, the money we pay for a rack of lamb, you don't want to waste the meat. But secondly, I love gnawing on bones. Aren't they great?
Absolutely. That's the best part.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. And enjoy.
Thank you.
Enjoy. Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Joanne on the line from Phoenix. Joanne, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, I have a basic cooking technique that is wreaking havoc in my kitchen.
What is it?
Every time I try to caramelize sugar, I'm moving along fine, and all of a sudden it just seizes up and goes back to granulated sugar again.
Yeah, and it looks gray, and it looks awful.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Do you stir it?
I stir. Well, I have two recipes. One that says stir continuously. The other one says stir till dissolved and then swirl.
Ooh. Okay. Both of them are about someone who has a death wish when it comes to cooking.
Right.
Okay. No, seriously. This is the thing. Cooking sugar is truly a very tricky deal, but one of the secrets is that the sugar, as it heats up, goes from one stage to another stage to another stage.
Right.
Okay? And they call it, you know, softball, hardball, hard thread. If your sugar in the pot reaches, let's say, for argument, stage three, which is just before caramelization, just
right,
before it starts to brown, and in the course of boiling, it's thrown up some sugar crystals on the side of the pot, and you wash them down or stir them back in, but they're still at stage one or stage two, you're going to throw the whole thing off. So here's what you do. You put it in the pot, and you do not stir it at all. You gradually heat it up. You keep it around medium heat until it's clear.
Right.
Okay. But as you're heating it, have a bowl of cold water and have a pastry brush, something that's heatproof. And as it's heating, just wash down the sides occasionally. Once it's clear, don't do anything. Just let it bubble. And what's going to happen is you've put sugar and water in the pot most of the time, right?
Right.
The water is just there to help the sugar along to melting.
Right.
as the bubbles get bigger and glossier, it's telling you that all the water has cooked away and now the sugar is cooking on its own, and gradually it is going to turn an amber color. And that's when it's caramelized. Now, one of the tricks is never leave it in the pot when it gets close to that color that you want.
Right.
Get it into another, use a metal bowl, a stainless steel bowl. It's going to continue cooking a bit once it's in the bowl, all right?
Right.
So always take it off when it's a little paler than you want it.
Ah, excellent.
And don't touch it. And, be really careful, because this is the worst kind of burn you can get, because it sticks and it's very hot. Don't stir it. Don't swirl it. Don't swish it. Don't do anything.
Don't do anything. No. Well, excellent. I didn't know if it was my wooden spoon.
No, I know, because I went through all that. I thought, if I breathed on it, I did something wrong. And, and my stove faced east, and maybe it should have faced
west. And that's exactly it. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to go try that.
Go try it. It's really easy and it's really great. And once you master it, you're going to just feel like, oh, I can do this in my sleep.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
Call us 800-537-5252 or do the email thing, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember that phone number. You can call us anytime, 800-537-5252, or email splendidtable.org. You have a great weekend. Let me leave you with this thought from Ambrose Bierce, who said, "Cabbage, a familiar kitchen garden vegetable about as large and wise as a man's head." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell, with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.